Hello, and welcome back to the Skatonauts podcast with me, your host, Paul Richards. On last week's episode, I sat down with the BAFTA award-winning filmmaker Mark Jenkin to discuss his new film, Rose of Nevada. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by the singer-songwriter Matilda Mann. Matilda grew up in Shepherd's Bush in West London and attended the Brit School, where she began writing and recording her own music. She came to wider attention as the runner-up in Glastonbury's Emerging Talent competition and has since supported the likes of Arlo Parks, Tom Odell and Wallows. Her debut album Roxwell came out in 2025, and now she's back with Kismet, a record drawing on the sounds of Al Green, Carole King and the Carpenters. Her single Bittersweet premiered as Radio 1's hottest record earlier this year, and she joined me in the studio for our conversation. You can watch video clips over on our YouTube channel at Scared to Dance, and if you're listening, please do like and subscribe as it really helps the show.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. We were just talking about the heatwave.
Yeah, that's classic British talk, isn't
it? And we're
it?
Very glad that it's
we
over.
We love talking about the weather.
So I saw that you played St. Matthias Church in Stoke Newington earlier in the year.
I did, yes.
We've promoted Scared to Dance gigs there in the past. It's a beautiful venue.
It is. It's so beautiful. I love church gigs.
How was that for you?
It's so nice. I really like acoustics in there, and I used to be in a choir in school.
Okay.
So it always feels like it's taken me back to my roots of choral music.
How was being in a choir at school?
I loved it so much. It was my favorite thing ever. I think it taught me a lot about harmonies and like trying to blend yourself amongst lots of voices. And I was an alto. But yeah, I loved it so much, and I'm really sad I'm not in one now. So maybe I'll join one.
And what kind of band setup did you have for the gig?
It was just me.
Just you?
Just me, myself and I, and a guitar. Again, going right back to how I started playing live, I guess, which was always just me and a guitar.
Do you prefer that, or do you prefer it with the band?
I guess it depends on the setting, on what kind of songs we're going to play. I love what playing with other people can bring to the live atmosphere of things. But I think sometimes if it's, you know, like a church gig, I think it's really nice to focus on the lyrics, especially if they're kind of soft songs and kind of emotional or romantic of some sense. And then I think like if you hear a whole band, you probably would tune in more to just the music that you're listening to rather than the lyrics sometimes.
So do you plan different sets with that in mind, I assume?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I'm supporting people, I like to kind of cater myself to kind of what music they have and stuff. So when I supported the Wallows, they've got like really fun, like upbeat music. So I think like having a band is very necessary to support a band like that. Yeah.
And around the time of that gig in St. Matthias Church, you played several European dates.
Yes.
How was that?
It was great. I love playing in Europe so much. It was very, very, very cold though. I've never been so cold. I felt it in my bones. And yeah, we were all just little ice children in the back of the on the way.
Where was the coldest place?
Actually, Germany.
Oh, whereabouts?
We went to Berlin, and it was snowing. It was like the coldest winter Germany's had in 20 years, they said, and we were like, ah, yay! Munich as well. It was also pretty cold, but we ended in Italy, in Milan, and that was a nice breeze of warmth. Sun-kissed.
Where in particular did you enjoy playing? Any new places on the itinerary?
I think it was the first time I played in Oslo.
Oh, Oslo's great.
It is. I unfortunately didn't get to see any of it because it was so cold that like you couldn't really walk 10 minutes down the street. But we started in Paris, which I really love. And my best friend lives there. So I go there when any excuse arises. But yeah, I loved all of it, really.
I think Oslo is the coldest place I've ever been. I did the club there probably about 10 years ago, and it was minus 20.
Yeah, yeah.
I did it in Bergen, and then we got the train over to Oslo, and it was unreal.
People were like skating on the river and stuff.
Yeah.
It's crazy, but it was lovely. Just very, very cold. So maybe I'll do more of like a springtime thing.
So I want to talk to you about your new album, Kismet. The title translates as Fate or Destiny. Where did that concept come from, and when did that become the album's central idea?
I think I'd written a few songs And they were kind of just like, they were all hopeful, I guess, and they were all about love in some sense, but also just kind of leaning into the idea that there's something of a plan for everyone, I think, or you don't have to worry too much sometimes, I think, just because the right thing will happen for you at the right time. And so there was just a lot of destiny talk in the room. We wrote this song called Inventing, which is the first single of the album, and we hadn't actually written the end, like the bridge at the end, and that ends with "It's Kismet," and we wrote that bridge and we were like, oh, I guess that's this album, it's pretty kismety. So ta-da.
So that overarching theme obviously came from that song, but what was in the air when you were recording the songs for the album? It seems to be a bit of a through line.
Yeah, well, I guess a lot of it was just hopeful stuff. Like we started writing, and I think I've always maybe gone down very emotional paths when I write. And a lot of the time I've written things that are very therapeutic for me. And then when we started writing this album, I was like, I'm kind of over being sad. I don't really want to dwell on that. And I feel very in love, and I feel like I love my friends, and I'm kind of choosing to be positive here and really like not take for granted all the things I have in my life. So I kind of just want to focus on that. And strangely, I think love songs are really hard to write effortlessly and like do love justice, I guess, without being too cheesy. So yeah, I think there was just a lot of joy and trying to choose that, I guess.
Yeah, I was reading that you described the album as being written from a place of hard-won peace and expensive joy. I wondered if you could expand on that just a little bit more. How would you describe where you were as a person when you were writing those songs? Was there something that had happened in your life that, you know, you wanted to switch from writing those sad songs to something more joyful?
Yeah, I think I've like found myself in a relationship that's very like sweet and calm. And I think there's not much overthinking needed. And I think I write a lot for my brain to like process things. I think very logically. So sometimes I don't really leave room to just feel things. And that's where songwriting is really important for me, because I think I'd write very subconsciously. And a lot of songs will come out of me without really knowing that that's how I felt about the situation. But I think I got a lot of that out of me in my last album. And so I wrote a song on that album called At the End of the Day, which if I could change anything, would actually put that last on my album, because I think it's a really good closing song instead of opening. Because that was like one of the last songs I wrote for that album. And it's very much like kind of done thinking about this all the time and dwelling on bad thoughts and situations. And, you know, there's nothing I can do. So I'm going to just choose to look forward, I guess. And that's what happens when we started writing Kismet. It was very much, well, you know, let's look at what is good in my life and what I feel happy and joyful about. And it's hard to be, maybe it's naive and you know, there's a lot of privilege in being happy, I guess. But I think it's really important to try and choose it where you can, because otherwise, you know, you can just get sucked into a hole of everything's terrible. So yeah, I think this is like an album of escape. And if you want to try and brighten up your day, maybe you'll play that.
It sounds like you find the songwriting very therapeutic for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you thought about why that might be?
I think that it's not. I think sometimes when you're being honest, it's usually to a person. And I think songwriting, you can just be doing it by yourself, or you can just be doing it with someone, and it's not about them. You know, when I write with producers, I'm not telling them of my feelings. They're just kind of there. And it doesn't really have to be that serious. Like, no one has to hear that song. And it's just a way of, sometimes it's good to say things just to hear how it sounds. And it doesn't actually have to mean anything. It's just kind of good to know where you are in your own headspace. So I think songwriting's really good at like tapping into that.
How do you find writing with producers?
I love it. I mean, it depends who you're writing with. But I've...
You can tell us about the good experiences. Yeah. Tell me about the bad ones.
I'll choose a positive. No, I mean, I've had mainly just like great experiences with producers and songwriters and stuff. But I think I've mainly found my work buddy, which is Jonah Summerfield. And I met him when I was 19. And yeah, we've written many, many songs together and we've done the entirety of this album together. And he's, you know, I think he's grown so much as a producer and a writer since I first met him. And same with me. Like, I think just as people, it's been really nice that we grew together. And yeah, he's just incredible at everything he plays and says.
How was it finding that dynamic with Jonah? Because you recorded the album at his North London studio pretty quickly. It's a quick turnaround from the first album to the second album.
Yeah. And I actually wrote down, because I thought it was really interesting, like the dates where we wrote all of the songs.
Okay.
And there's like a week where we wrote four.
Oh, wow.
In one day after the other.
How is it finding that flow? You obviously hit a groove.
Well, yeah, we definitely hit a groove. And I think like once we realized that it was like a joyful album, and I think getting your references right and like the concept of the album is probably the hardest thing, because otherwise it's just an endless void of so many things you could write about and what kind of album it could be. So I think once you kind of actually, you know, box it off a little bit, then it gives you just weirdly more freedom to kind of just really dive into that one lane and just make it the best that it can be.
How did you come to work together?
I don't know. We were just put into a session.
Okay.
Many years ago. he was at home at that point, and so was I. And then COVID happened, so I didn't see him for like a year. And then I saw him again and we wrote Paper Mache World. And I like adore his girlfriend as well, who's also an artist. And it's always just so nice going there. It feels like a second home.
So how do you know which songs to keep that are your own, that you've written on your own? And which ones do you take to him and say, hey, oh, this might need something else? Or
I do write by myself, but really not as much as I used to. Just, I don't know if that's a good thing. But I think at my core, I'm very folk. And I find it really hard to write songs that aren't like based off of the music that is there, I guess. So like playing a guitar, I kind of, in my room, I think I probably do go back to just being quite folky. But with Jonah, when he's got all of his instruments and there's like amazing sounds coming out of his weird synths, then I feel like I'm like, oh, this is that kind of song. Okay, I'll write to that. So I always write concepts, I guess, and I bring those in, or just one line lyrics, and then see what tumbles out of me. But usually we just start from scratch every session.
The reference points on the album are really interesting. Al Green, Bill Withers, Carol King, The Carpenters. How do those artists find their way into what you were making?
I would actually say a lot of that is Jonah. And I think he really took a lead on this album musically, especially because, again, like I think my strength is probably in folk and like the lyricism of stuff. But he was really bringing out all kind of introducing me to the musical elements of those artists and like the funk in bass parts and drum sounds and stuff. And like, he got me out of being scared of synths, you know, like, so.
Were you scared of synths?
Terrified. No, I don't know. I think I just have a normal, like a strange association with them being like the songs I listened to when I was really young that were like a completely different sound. You know, when you just have really random of relations to an instrument.
What were yours?
I thought synths were like really cool dance sounds and stuff. And like, not being a producer, I didn't realize how, you know, you can make any instrument what you choose it to be. And like, it can be really subtle and sit within a song and not be like a huge synth solo, I guess, is what I always imagined. Like, I always thought bass was purely for like funky songs. And then of course it's in like every song you ever listen to. So I think it was just things like that. And I also have quite a soft voice. So I think I always thought I was just destined for soft songs, because why could I ever sing something cool? So I think it was just really nice to kind of let him create this world with me. And yeah, and we just kind of went into like the happy side of things.
How do you find your voice with those new layers coming in with synths and additional bass parts?
Well, I think that's like listening a lot to those artists that you mentioned, and like the Carpenters themselves, like they're so cool. But she has she has the most unique and elegant voice, I think. But I don't know, it's kind of just, I think it's so nice to have things like kind of just juxtaposition to your voice and the music of it. So things like that was very nice.
The first single, The Fig Tree, draws on Sylvia Plath, a metaphor about the paralysis of life choices. But I think you've kind of flipped it into something much more warm and grounding rather than anxious. How did that reframing happen?
Well, my friend actually went to uni and she dropped out. And it was all kind of based off of that, because I didn't actually start a degree, so it was kind of a lie. But I think it was more just like, I didn't actually go to university. And I think in a way that kind of let me just observe everyone who did. And they were all kind of freaking out about how this was like an amazing time, but then they were still going to have to eventually leave uni and actually make decisions of what they wanted to do. And I think there's a little bit of a flaw in the education system that at 18, you're meant to go and choose what job you want to do and what you want to do in life. And I don't know, I think there's no room to, or no one really tells young people that they have time. They have so much time to figure things out and everything is going to be okay. And I think things that matter in life that are really important are people around you and just having kind people that are nice and supportive. And I'm super lucky that I have that in my life. So I don't know, it was more like, it's going to be okay, guys. Like, no one knows what they're doing, but you know, just make sure everyone around you is good. And so are you.
And how are they now?
They're fine. Yeah. But, I mean, most of them are freaking out, but that's what being in your 20s is for, I guess. And for the rest of your life, honestly, I think you'll just, again, very kismet. I think you'll find the right path when it comes along, and someone randomly might introduce you to a job you didn't even consider and things like that. So I think it's very much just keeping an open mind and being honest with yourself. If you enjoy what you're doing, or you know there's something you really want to do, but it might seem quite daunting or scary, like maybe go for it.
Doesn't sound like you have any regrets about not going to university.
I don't.
No.
but you know, uni is for very different reasons for different people and stuff. Like for music, I went to quite a musical sixth form and I feel like I learned a lot there. And uni was like a backup plan, to be honest, if I just worked in a pub for a year and I did sessions during the day. And I was kind of like, I'll do this for a year and see what happens. And hey, if it doesn't work out, then maybe I'll apply to uni and I need to learn more about these things. But again, that's like a very privileged sense of, I just got to live at home in London and figure things out for a bit. Like I was given time and support by my parents to be like, it's okay. Like you don't have to go to uni. So, you know, things like that are always really lucky, but yeah, you know.
I think the European system is far more sensible. They tend to wait.
Yeah,
and then
they
go
do.
To university, you know, they'll work for a year or 2 years, or you can do modules in your mid to late 20s, or you know, you can take credits.
I think also things have changed so much where like you don't have to have a degree for a lot of things anymore, and you probably learn a lot more working in a job than you would maybe studying it. I don't know, it's
kind of just like, the levels of debt.
Yeah,
it's
a lot of debt.
It's astonishing.
Yes, but then again, like you know, I think you can meet your favorite people at university, mm-hmm. which is something sometimes I have a bit of FOMO over, you know, like a lot of people who go to university have like these really big university groups, and that just looks really lovely. And
well, I think there are different paths. I mean, when I went to university, absolutely. I think I did a modern history and politics degree, which is no relation at all with what I do for a living.
But did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed aspects of it. I think the education could have been better. I think there could be more hours of actual education.
Yeah.
I think for the amount you pay, actually you're not getting that much education. But the fees were a lot lower when I went to university. So it's not like the levels of now. So I don't know what advice I'd give to someone. I think it depends what area you want to eventually work in.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the whole thing about like my parents' generation is just a completely different world to mine. And like it was so much easier for them to rent and buy flats, and just like the economy in general was so different to how it is now. And most of my friends live at home because that's what life in London is like. And I don't know, everything has changed so much. So it's I think really important to question a lot of things before you do them.
Well, I think even since the pandemic, the cost of living, specifically in London, because that's where we are, it's just gone through the roof. When I was in my early 20s, we could live in a flat share with our friends and we were signing on and, you know, it wasn't easy, but you could at least do it. And now that generation can't do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of my friends aren't in like music or creative. Mm. They just have jobs in journalism and teaching and stuff. But like, it seems that even in that area of life, they aren't getting paid the way that the world is, like how expensive it is to live in.
The cost of living, no.
Yeah, so it's just, everything's gone tits up.
So what were you doing whilst all your friends were at uni? Was there a few of you that didn't go?
To be fair, from my sixth form, nobody went.
Oh, really?
Because we all did music.
Yeah.
And a few people went and I think they had a really nice time. But I think especially teaching the arts is a really hard thing to do, to teach it, I think. Again, it's kind of like learning another language. It might be better to go and live in France. Mm. And you might pick French up a bit quicker rather than Duolingo. Actually, no, Duolingo is great. I won't go down on that. I think most of my friends didn't go, but a lot of them did, and they went into learning English and stuff like that. I just worked night shifts at a pub, and then I just had sessions in the day, and so it was quite a nice, slow introduction to the music industry, I guess. It's just been really nice to meet so many people who do this as a living. And I guess when I was 18, I was working with a lot of people in their 30s who had wisdom for me and guided me into how to write a song. So that was really helpful and, great.
And you studied at the Brit School. How was that?
It was good. It was chaos in the best way. But
can you tell us about how you get into the Brit School and what's the path that took you there?
The youngest age you can go there is 14. And so you can do your GCSEs, which is in the UK, we take those exams at 16. But I just went for sixth form, which was 16 to 18 years old. And I just did music. And you apply by, I think, while ago now, I think you give like a written statement or an essay, maybe. I might have made that up. And then you do an audition process. And there was about 50 people in my class. It's in East Croydon, so there was a long commute for everybody. but it was kind of like the Hogwarts Express, but like fame. Because everyone was getting the Southern Rail service to Selhurst. And everyone was just doing pirouettes. Okay. In the corridors. But it was really interesting going from like a state school in Shepherd's Bush to this school where everyone was so passionate and had such big dreams and was really into like the arts the same way I was, if not more. And like everyone there was, had been going to gigs since they were like 3 years old. And I was like, wow, I've never been to a gig. And it was, yeah, it was great. It was such a whirlwind of a place. There's a lot going on.
How was the audition process? I mean, quite terrifying.
It was, but I think I went expecting not to get in. So I just wasn't that nervous. I don't know. I was already like, hey, probably won't get in, so whatever. but they do, like, they ask you to sing a song. And I think I did Paolo Nutini. And then they ask you to play an original song. And then they do like a little theory test with you. And they ask what you want to be or what you want to do or like what it is you like about music. I think I can't really remember.
Can't remember what you said?
Nope. but I like wrote stupid little songs since I was probably like 7. So I think I just probably went off of that.
Where did that come from when you were 7? Did you come from a musical family at all? Did your parents play?
Well, they like to think they can, but no, my mom's an art teacher, so I guess she has the artsiness in her. And then my dad's a producer for TV adverts, so his life is organization. So I like to think a good balance. But my parents aren't really musical at all, but they love music like so much. And since as little as I can remember, we would listen to songs in the car, and my dad specifically would talk about the lyrics that he loved, and he loves documentaries and learning about why his favorite artists write the way they do and their influences and everything. And my mum just really likes the feel of music. So she just likes things you can dance to and that are really fun and make you feel good. So again, a combination.
So what was on in the car?
A lot of Earth, Wind & Fire, a lot of The Beatles, a lot of Joni Mitchell, Nick Drake.
I can see where the folk influence came through.
Oh, yeah, they shoved that down my throat. No, a lot of Laura Marling, but I kind of rediscovered her myself when I was about 13. And that was like a really, really big part of why I started writing my own songs. And on guitar, especially.
Was that the first instrument you picked up?
The first instrument I picked up was probably the recorder, because everyone in primary school learns the recorder. And then, again, like, my parents were really encouraging that, like, if I wanted to learn an instrument, they'd find a way to, like, let me have a lesson on it of some sorts. And my secondary school was actually really, really good at... they had like music scholars, so you could apply based on where you lived, just like living near it, or you could apply for a music scholarship, and they gave you a free lesson in an instrument. For some reason I picked the flute, and I like whacked my teacher in the face by accident on my first lesson, and so I was mortified and I never went back. And then I picked up the guitar.
How's your flute playing now?
So I'm traumatized, so I'll never do it again. But no, he's okay. yeah.
So just going back to the Brit School, for those who aren't in London, can you just explain a bit more about the Brit School and how it works?
Yeah, there are a lot of people who boarded nearby because it's free. But I think like there were people from Liverpool and Wales and stuff that, because it's an amazing school with great facilities and stuff. And you can just board at one of the houses where like ex-students went. So like people who genuinely grew up just in that area and went to that school, sometimes their parents rent out a room to you, which is so sweet. But yeah, it's great. And there was about 50 people in my year, and there's about 9 strands of things you can do. So I just did music. You can do musical theatre or just theatre, dance.
You weren't tempted by anything else?
I would not have gotten in on anything else, to be honest. I mean, I love musical theatre, to be honest, but I'm not good at, I just like it, you know, I'm not good at performing, really. Even though I was forced to be Bill Sykes at my old school. Don't ask me why. I didn't go to a girl's school. Like, there were boys who wanted that part, and they were still like, you, you'll be the evil, scary man. but yeah, it was great. And I really liked that you didn't have to do A-levels. you just do the subject that you have gone there for, but you can take up extra curricular ideas if you want. And like, you're still qualified to apply to any kind of uni you'd like to go to. So yeah, like, a lot of people did go on to go to university.
Mm.
I actually did apply to Goldsmiths and I didn't get in. And I'm not bitter about it. It's fine. But I had tonsillitis and they just couldn't care less.
Really? That feels a bit harsh. You should...
I know, but kismet.
Because there you go.
Then I just did a bunch of sessions and actually... I mean, I would have reapplied at some point. Cause I do, yeah. But I think it's, thank God I didn't get in, actually. So there's a rejection that turned out good.
Sounds like you're very happy with your path.
I am. I'm really happy. Yeah. Well, I'm very lucky that people have like been there to guide me and like help me. Like, I met my manager when I was 18. I've been with him since. And like, that's just luck, really, that I got a lucky one. You know, I know so many people who've been through about three or four managers. Mm. And that's a really hard relationship and dynamic to get right. And I am just really lucky that he's super nice and really good at his job. Yeah.
Did you know that music was something you always wanted to pursue and ideally as a career? Or there was no plan B?
I never planned to be an artist at all, even at Brit School. I wanted to be a lyricist or like a top liner for other people, because I've always thought my voice was too like small and I had terrible stage fright. I had to sit in a chair till I was probably 20, like when I performed, because my legs would shake so much. I just thought I was going to fall over, or it looked like I was really cold. but yeah, I don't know. There was nothing naturally in me that thought I would ever be an artist, or it's more like I kind of looked at movie stars and thought like, oh, you were born a movie star, you know, you were never normal. but you are, you know, like people just grow up to be what they become. But no, I just wanted to do it for, I just loved music, and there was nothing else in my life that's ever so naturally come to me that I like really enjoy. Like the music theory side of it, I'm not good at, but I enjoyed learning about it, and it didn't feel like a chore to study that and work on it, you know? And there's that saying of, you know, you do something you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And it's kind of true.
How did you get over your stage fright?
Force.
Force.
but it's kind of that thing of, like, if I don't do it, then I don't get to do it, which sounds... simple enough, but it's kind of, you know, here's an opportunity to support an artist you really love. I can't say no because I'm scared. That's stupid. So I just forced myself on stage, and yeah.
Does first, it ever come back?
Yeah, around small crowds it does.
Okay.
Yeah, the bigger the, that's also the other thing, like the smaller the crowd, even though I've done small crowds and like really big crowds now, the hardest is still the small ones, and that's where you start. At least I did. So you actually do start, I think, in the hardest way. And then it gets easier.
Well, so you supported some quite big people quite early on.
Yeah.
How was that for you?
It was amazing. I mean, like I was super obsessed with the Staves. And so supporting them was really, really, really fun. And they're like such a fun group. And they kind of showed me the joy in performing live and stuff. And that was just really magical to watch them every night. I watched all of their performances. And then I supported Arlo Parks, and she was great, and someone like the same age as me. So it was really cool to just see like the beginning of her journey and stuff and watch her blow up. My first person I supported was actually Bieber DB in a church. we were both 18, and it was, I think, her first time ever performing. And we were both like, what the hell do we do? Like, I don't know how you play. I don't know how you do a gig.
How did that come about, that gig?
Through my agent, Will, who I've also been with since I was 18. Again, luck of the cards. He's just really good at his job and lovely.
Well, talking about going from small to big, your track Inventing really blew up on TikTok. How's that as an experience?
Very interesting because it's my first independent release. And it's done better than like anything I've ever released with a label. Maybe it's just a one-off song of some sorts, but I think it's very interesting that I came into the music industry in 2019 when a lot, you know, it was just before the pandemic, and then suddenly like TikTok is king. And the only thing that labels ever really said to me was like, you know, that's great. Like, what have you done for TikTok? You know, there was never really any conversation about music or like trying to build me as an artist. It was all up to me really. Which in some sense is good because, you know, I probably actually should come up with that because I am the artist and I'm the one that's going to have to perform it and sing it and write it and everything. But I find it interesting that like I'm doing the exact same amount that I was, but I now own 90% of it.
Mm.
Whereas I only earned like 20% back then. So, sometimes, you know, it's really good for people to take a bet on you and sign you and invest their money and their time in you. And that's also really crucial. And I probably wouldn't be an artist if I hadn't had that support early on, because I wouldn't have been able to fund myself financially to, you know, like I invested all of that into going on tour and meeting people and spending my time writing songs. So it was also incredibly necessary for me, and I wouldn't have changed anything that I've had. You know, it's just the music industry is just an odd place. And I think it's trying to find what works for you. And I think I probably was a bit more like, what are you going to do for me? And actually I should have been like, what can I do to get myself out there and see what they do? I don't know.
How was it going independent for you?
It was terrifying.
It's a big decision to make.
Yeah.
I assume you were on a contract for another album. So
no, I wasn't. I didn't have anyone really like, I was out of my deal, and there were other labels I could have gone with, but I thought like, oh, it seems like it's the same thing that I've just come from. And, you know, releasing it with this distribution, maybe like there's less people to go through and communicate with, and like it might be a bit faster if we just go independent. And then just, and also there's fear behind that of like, well, I can't blame anyone else if this goes wrong. So I guess I gotta go crazy on social media. And like I have an amazing creative director, Ben Harris, who's literally made all of the visuals for all of my albums, songs and everything. And an amazing stylist, Tegan, who's I think really helped, like they both really helped me shape the artist that I am visually, which I think I never really had anyone to help me do that. You know, like I naturally just know about music, I guess, and like singing it. I just want to sing songs. But that's not really what gets you far anymore. You have to like be able to do all of it really. And I'm really, really thankful for those two as well to like, I don't know, make me look the way that I feel.
It sounds like having that in team around you is really, really important.
Absolutely, yeah. I think building your own team is super necessary. You know, it has to be people that really get you, but I think also like see you bigger than you are and like strive for greatness or just strive for like what you all want to become, you know, and really have that in mind and stuff. And I think of myself quite small, I guess. So it's just been really nice to work with people that are like, let's make this video like really like viral and creative, and it's going to have this amazing hook, and we're going to film it on these cameras, and Tegan has made like amazing outfits that I wouldn't ever see in a shop and be like, yeah, I can wear that. You know, she's like, you can wear this here, put this on. And I'm like, wow, I'm a whole new person, but still me. So yeah, I think there's just a lot of like growing that has happened this year, and a lot of confidence that's been handed to me. And yeah, I think in just every way, writing a happy album has made me happier.
You worked with Ben Harris, as you mentioned, on the previous album, with the singles Make It Go Home, Days Are Confused, Say It Back, and now The Fig Tree.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how important that visual world is, and how do the two of you develop ideas together?
Yeah. Well, I think it's really important now, the visual side of your music and having something to promote on socials that people can see. Because personally, when a new song comes out, if I watch it with a music video, I do find that I like it quicker. And I'm suddenly more invested, and it's like a whole world that I can like see and hear. And I think at this time, you know, everything is very quick and attention spans are short, so you really got to grab them. And Ben just has like such incredible ideas, and he is someone who definitely thinks big. And he's not like, you know, we're not going to do something simple. You deserve this like crazy idea that like really works with your music, and this is how you see it, you know. And that's been amazing, I guess, because also I would never know how to branch that world of creating such incredible videos. So yeah, that's also been amazing. But we just usually, he does a lot of interrogating, as he calls it, of what songs are about and how I see it. We make a lot of Pinterest boards and we go over a lot of references and look at artists I really like and old artists and how their look is and stuff. And yeah, that's how we've landed on our videos, which I love.
How do you feel about the social media side of the job?
I mean, it's frustrating that it's such a huge part of being an artist, but also I think like it's a job I really love, you know, being an artist, and I think there's nothing else I'd want to be. And so in a annoyingly positive manner, if like the downside of my job is having to post online, like I'll take it because I love doing what I do. And also I think it's like, it's frustrating when people like labels are like, just post, you know, just do that all the time. And it's like, well, you're saying that like it's easier than it is. And it does take a lot of thought and work, especially to post the way that feels authentic to you. And I, you know, I have to look at myself way more than I ever should, because I have to always be filming things and taking pictures. But like, whatever, I've done it enough now that it's not so daunting. And like Ben, for an example, he's an amazing director, but he's like, oh gosh, I have to post this amazing video that I made. But he's not used to posting all the time. So it's all my friends that just don't post that much. It's quite daunting to them. And I'm like, ah, I don't care. I do it every day. And I think the more you do something, it just becomes habit and it becomes less of a scary thing. And you kind of very quickly figure out how to make it work for you, I guess.
How was it when you got more attention via TikTok with Inventing? Was that, did you find that hard to deal with, or was it exciting?
It was really funny. Some people comment hilarious things, and sometimes they'll have arguments in my comment section. It's really funny. Like I posted a video of like the behind the scenes of making The Fig Tree, where Ben is actually pouring a bucket of water on my head. and it's freezing cold and stuff. And in the comment section, it was just loads of people being like, why didn't you just put warm water in the bucket? And someone being like, well, you would be able to see that it's warm water and it's amazing. It's like such a funny conversation and I find it really entertaining. But maybe I won't put that in this. But I really like, yeah, it's interesting. So I don't know what answer I just gave you.
Well, it sounds like it sounds good if you can wear it quite lightly.
Yeah, I'll do it better.
I think.
Can you ask me the same question?
Well, I've interviewed various people who really don't enjoy the social media side of things.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't enjoy the social media side of things.
No.
Personally, but it is sort of a necessary evil, so people yeah. know that you're doing something.
Yeah.
But like I think filming a podcast.
Yeah.
Just being audio now.
But I think imagine if someone else was in charge and they did it terribly and it looked really bad, you'd be like, no, let me do it. And then I guess it's kind of a nice way of presenting yourself the way you want to be seen.
Yeah, if you're able to have creative control, that, I think it's incredibly important. Like,
yeah,
I think it'd be very uncomfortable if you had someone breathing down your neck.
No, that wouldn't be fun at all.
Yeah. So how much are you enjoying this new album? It sounds like maybe a bit of a relief to be out of the album label system.
Yeah.
And sounds like you're really enjoying it.
I am. It's been, it's interesting. Like it's kind of, the campaign's kind of only just started. And, you know, there's a lot of pros and cons of being independent. It's definitely a lot more scary because it's a lot of it's all on you and it working out. And, you know, you like a lot of labels help with making things bigger than like getting there. And especially with just like not being a huge artist, I have to really like put it out there so that as many people can hear it and see it as possible. But yeah, it is really, it's been really fun. I'm really enjoying it so far and I'm really excited to play it live.
Yeah. You have some UK dates coming at the end of the year.
Yeah.
So where are you playing and what are you looking forward to?
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm playing for the first time at Shepherd's Bush Empire, which is
the local gig
hometown.
You?
Yeah. Down the road. And I've never played there before. I've seen a few gigs there, but I've never played there. So I'm really excited about it. And I think we're going to have some live horns. And yeah, it's going to be a family affair on stage, honestly. It's going to have a lot of my friends on playing just as many instruments as I can get on that stage, to be honest. And we're doing some other little, we're doing other ones in other parts of the UK. Yeah, hopefully the rest of the world at some point. I really want to do, there's so many places I want to play in the world. People are always sad that I'm not playing like America or Asia, but like it would cost me about 50 grand, so I can't.
Yeah, the logistics, if you're doing it independently are. I mean, I interviewed, but let's say it's a legacy band and they were telling me about the cost of touring America and it was lucky if they broke even. And this is
honestly
a band that sold a lot of records.
Yeah.
When people used to buy records.
Yeah, it is great. Like live touring and everything, like you either are from people that can financially support you or you're signed to a huge label. And I think like it is sad that like I've just saved a lot of money and I put that back into my career, which I'm, you know, luckily enough to be in a position that I get to do that. But that's also my choice in how I spend my money.
Mm.
But going on tour, even if I sell out all of my venues, I'll probably lose like 20 grand just because of like paying my band and rehearsals, hiring rehearsal spaces, like petrol, driving. Like you have to give a percentage of the venue and commission and everything, like it all adds up and it all makes sense. But unfortunately, like that's just how it goes, really, especially when you're doing like smaller venues.
Sustainable do you think that is for you?
For me, I don't know. It's kind of, I really have to weigh up what I think it will do for me in the future and stuff. So like supporting the Wallows was an incredible investment and I'm like so thankful I got to do that, and it meant supporting them, like so many people then translated to coming to my live shows, and you know, that's a great decision, you know. And I don't regret any live show I've done. Like they're always amazing and they've taught me how to play live and how to enjoy it, and the more I've done it the more I like it and it's my favorite thing now. But it's just, it's more frustrating that like I can't play in America because I can't afford to. And so, you know, one day maybe I will, and that would be great. Same with like Asia. I mean, everywhere in the world really I'd like to play, but I think it will come in time.
Have you thought about what's next after this album?
Another album.
Another album, but independently?
No,
or,
I don't.
You know, it can be very, very exhausting being independent and keeping things going. Speaking yeah. from experience.
Yeah, I mean.
It takes a lot.
To be independent.
Stubbornness, I think, is the...
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I would never not sign again. I think I'm very much open to just kind of whatever happens, really. Like, I didn't really expect Inventing to do as well as it did, just because, like, I'm cynical. And, you know, I might not ever have a moment like that again. I really hope I do. Yeah. I really hope that this album does well, because I'm really proud of it. But, you know, I'm just kind of, I'm not really thinking too far ahead. Just kind of, like, going month by month.
Well, I think the single on the new album, Bittersweet, is really fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the writing process behind that?
Yeah, that one's actually really odd because I didn't realise what it was about until I played it live. I guess it's probably the only song on the album that's kind of a sad song. Like, it is a love song in some sense, but it was, again, like, I write very subconsciously, and I think that was a song that I kind of sat down with the guitar and... started to write it, and Jonah was asking me loads of questions. He was like, what is this about? And I was like, I don't know. And we finished it and we loved it, but I couldn't, you know, like, visualize what it was I was talking about until I played it live on the previous tour I just did. And I was like, wow, it's about like this person that I kind of grew up with, and just they're in a certain, they live in a certain part of my life timeline, I guess. And though I look at that with a fond memory, I don't know how they'd fit in my life now. And they kind of, I just associate them with that time. And it's bittersweet not really being able to have those memories back, I guess, or like you don't get to have them now. So it's just, yeah, it's a song that has many layers to me, but I love it.
As we said, you're going on tour in October, and you've supported many artists. You mentioned Wallows and the Staves, also Arlo Parks and Tom Odell. Was there anything that you took from those experiences that was a really good learning experience for you?
I think supporting Tom Odell was amazing. That was like arenas. And that was crazy because I played on the O2 stage, and I don't know, I didn't even ever think I would do that. But I also played by myself. You know, I just played with me on guitar. I don't know, I think I was really proud that I did that, because to think that, like, I used to be so scared to go on stage by myself. And now I did it after playing with bands and everything, and like having a lot of comfort and having a band around me. I did find it really daunting, the idea of going on stage to open for this icon with just a guitar. And I think I was always like, oh gosh, I won't be like good enough, or I won't be captivating enough. But I just had a lot of fun, and I was just really proud of myself that I did it, to be honest, because I was like, this is crazy. But he has such a nice fan base. Like, they are so sweet and they're really supportive. And I think that's also like a crucial thing as a support act, is coming into another artist's world and like their fan base, and trying to like tap into what they're like and what they like to listen to and stuff. And that, yeah, they're just so sweet, and I had the best time ever. And yeah.
It sounds like you've met a lot of the right people along the way.
I have, yes. Yeah. I'm very lucky. But yeah, I love supporting people, and same with Role Model as well. Like, he had such a cool group of fans coming down, and like, it's so nice hearing when people come to my shows that they came because they had seen me support someone. And I don't know, that also gives me a lot of confidence that like I am okay live, and like maybe that stays with them.
One final question we always ask on the podcast: which album have you heard in the last 12 months that you would recommend?
That's really hard because everyone old. And their mother has released an album
it
this
year. It can
be
new.
I am such a fan of Ryan Beattie. Like, I love that man so much. And he has an incredible new album out. So maybe that one, because I just love his songwriting and I love his voice so much. I also loved his most recent music video for the Secret Language song. Just, I think he has like such a unique look at being an artist and life. And he's great. And I love him. Yeah.
Well, Matilda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved it.
Thanks to Matilda Mann for joining me today, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Matilda is on tour in the UK in October, and her new album Kismet is out now. The Skate Dance Club Night is back on Saturday at the George Tavern with the Last Dinner Party as our guest DJs. Tickets have sold out, but you can join the waiting list on Dice. I'll be back next week when my guest is Owen Williams from The Tubs. I'll be talking to him about his many bands, from Drowning Gruesome to X Void, his career in music, and his new book, Atrocity Exhibitions, Breathing in the TikTok Underworld, which is one of my favourite books of the year. We will also have news of our film night returning this autumn to Pitch House Central. This podcast was produced at Third Floor Recording.